Welcome to the podcast that's all about solutions. If you're tired of complaining about tyranny and you want to take action to create a freer world, this is the place for you. Join us as we ask, what then must we do? All right, I am here today with Dom Scarcella, author of Good Neighbor, Bad Citizen. And this is, I love this book. I finished reading it. It's very, very short. And in case you couldn't guess, it's about Jesus. I'll just say very quickly, you've taken a really, I think, important idea, a very critical idea, not just about religion, but about our whole culture and our society and how we approach, you know, thinking about the world, how we approach our relationship to authority, to our social structures. And you've just distilled it and just, you know, gone through your examples very concisely. This is really, really nicely done. Let's just start by introducing you a little bit. Who are you? What's your background? Why did this come to you?
Well, the idea is something that I've reflected on for a long time. I've never written a book before. I do have a journalism background. So I've written articles, I've been a reporter, I've been an editor, I've done business-to-business work, those kinds of things as well. And I've been a musician, so I understand kind of connecting with an audience and whatnot. But from the standpoint of authoring a book, this was a first for me. And I really did it in order to learn the publishing platforms, not because I wanted to write a book.
Oh, interesting.
So I was just trying to learn the publishing platforms, the self-publishing platforms, and it dawned on me, okay, I'm going to need a book to really learn these things. So I wrote a book, and it had to be something that I could do fairly quickly, that I knew the material, I had a handle on it, and it turned into this. And you know, it's you were mentioning it's a short read. Yeah, it's the body of the book is about 10,000 words, so the average adult reads 230 to 240 a minute. It's a 45-minute read. If you go slowly, and you can, because it is designed, it could be used as a meditative aid. If you want to go more slowly, it'll take you longer. But if you just wanted a cover to cover read it, it's 45 minutes or so. And you could see there, this is the spine of the book. This is the Amazon copy. I was told that the book was not big enough to have any type on the spine. Yep. So it's a blank spine. Mine just has this little caution tape here because it's the author copy. So they send you the caution tape through it. But it's barely big enough to get a spine rather than the staples down the middle like a magazine.
Right.
It's meant to be short. It's meant to be something that you can revisit. But it's not meant to be something that, you know, I thought, oh, I'm going to write a book because I'm a big author or something. I'm really kind of a nobody. And in a sense, I think that helps the book, because one of the big themes about the book is that truth does not emerge from social authority. Truth does not emerge from status. It's something very different than that. So
big lesson from the last few years too.
Right. I mean, I would be a hypocrite if I were out here telling everybody, read this book because I'm a big deal. You know, they said, why don't you do an about author section somewhere in the book? And I said, well, no, I don't have anything. I really don't have anything relevant to tell people about me that would make them understand the material anymore. And I didn't want me to get in the way. So,
yeah, that's a really important point, because, you know, I think it's always been true. But and apologies for the dog noise in the background. But I think especially after these last few years, people, at least people who are using their critical reasoning faculties, are looking at the world and saying, these stamps of approval don't really mean that much. And we really do, as uncomfortable as it is, as much work as it is, we really do have to sort of examine everything for ourselves. If you're going to have an opinion about something, you really do have to look for yourselves. And that's uncomfortable. That's not an easy thing. You know, it's much easier to say, oh, this guy, you know, got his degree from Harvard and whatever. He's, you know, got the stamp of approval from the CDC. And we've now learned that you know, that's not necessarily an indication. It might be, but it might be the opposite. It's not necessarily an indication of how well somebody grasps something, that we really do have to use our own faculties to understand things. And I think that's kind of a, it shouldn't be, but it's kind of a revolutionary idea in our culture. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you've taken that approach.
You mentioned something there that it's not easy to do. Appeal to authority, appeal to majority. These are logical fallacies. They are mistakes mm-hmm. in the logical process of drawing conclusions. And all logical fallacies are shortcuts. Every one of them. Mm-hmm. All logical fallacies, prejudice, those are ways to skip ahead to the conclusion without doing the work.
Yeah.
And so, yes, if you're intimidated by the effort involved in doing your own critical thinking, it's very easy to just look to somebody and say, well, I'll do what I'm told.
Mm-hmm.
That cuts out a lot of steps for you to do what you're told.
And the other thing, and so, and I learned this as a professional journalist,
mm-hmm.
it takes a lot of time to really get to the bottom of even a simple story. You know, it takes some amount of effort to have some understanding of what's really going on. And so what that means is that you don't really get to have an opinion about everything. You don't, mm-hmm. there's not enough time in the day for each of us to have informed opinions about everything. And mm-hmm. yet there's this social pressure that you should have an opinion about everything. And so that's kind of a tough, I think it takes some integrity to say, you know, I don't know enough about this to have an opinion on it.
There's something I heard, it's a term called relevance realization. That as humans, we're very good at making things irrelevant. Like mm-hmm. right now, there's a million things happening in my home that I'm not paying attention to, whether it's the sound of the refrigerator cycling up, heat running through the radiator somewhere, you know, in the apartment building, noise outside, the change in ambient lighting as the clouds roll through across the window. There are so many things happening that we don't pay attention to that allows us to focus. And so, yeah, relevance realization is a very human thing to do, to say, look, this doesn't matter. This does. And I think what we found out over the last few years is that a lot of the things that we took for granted mattered in ways that we should have been more alert to. And some of mm-hmm. the belief and veracity we were placing in, say, institutions or other people turned out to be unwarranted. And okay, I need to revisit that because that's more relevant. Like, for instance, I don't pay much attention to we're recording this mid-December. Some of the presidential campaign cycles have started. There are debates going on with the candidates. I don't pay attention at all to the debates these clowns are having. I don't care. But I know the issues of social interaction and economics and fairness and natural human rights. You know, I know those things cold, but I'm not going to pay attention to a bunch of people up on a debate stage arguing over, you know, which country should the U.S. invade next? Because I know they're all wrong. Whichever answer they give, they're wrong.
Yeah.
Like, unless somebody has the guts to say none, I know they're all wrong. I don't have to know what the laundry list of each one of them, all the things they want to do wrong. I know coercive civil authority is inherently, intrinsically evil. I know that. I don't need people to continuously demonstrate it to me. Like, I've already got it.
Yeah.
So I don't have to pay attention to campaign slogans or anything like that. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm unaware of the terrible things that governments do. But it's not worth my time to pay attention to their sales pitch.
Yeah. So you made an interesting statement. Coercive civil authority is evil.
Yes.
I think there are a lot of Christians who don't see it that way. And so what you're saying,
they used to.
Well, did they? I mean, at what point? I mean, I don't know much about you know, the history of the church. But it seems, you know, when you talk to Christians nowadays, and I realize
I get into it in station two.
Okay, yeah, let's let me see. So yeah, so you go through the
early church are
outcasts here.
The early church are outcasts. I mean, they understand this very much. I get into a bit in station two and what happens with Constantine. Constantine is, if you know vaguely Christian history, Constantine is a Roman emperor in the early 300s AD. And he, as the spin goes, Constantine converts to Christianity. Which frankly is not true, because if he had converted to Christianity, he would have had to have renounced being emperor.
I would think so, yeah.
But he didn't do that. What Constantine did is between him and some of his cronies within the church officialdom, he converts the church back to sort of some Roman imperialistic paganism, for lack of a better term. And it's been kind of 1700 years of having to deal with that. But the idea of good neighbor, bad citizen is that the early church is, they're outcasts within the dominant social order. And they don't behave that way at all to each other. It's not until Constantine sort of recognizes the popularity of the church and tries to co-opt it, and successfully does.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And it's basically Constantine flattering the church and saying, look, I will stop the persecutions. And then he makes inroads. And within a few years, you've got church officials delivering apologetics for the Roman Empire. This is crazy. A few years earlier, the Roman Empire had been persecuting them, rounding them up, torturing them, killing them, and doing it for sport. And, you know, now you've got, you know, people like Eusebius of Caesarea sort of redescribing the structure of the church as if it's imperial and sort of parallel. And it's crazy to read as someone who understands the early church as I do.
So you're saying this is the point in history where, so there was initially, there was the Church of Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. and it followed Jesus's teachings and was, you know, was faithful to what he taught and his beliefs, and that Constantine coming in is what changed that into more of a political power-based structure. Is that accurate?
Yes, it's cronyism. It's you know, the church for those first few centuries, they were undermining these governments wherever they went. That's why they were persecuted, and it was part of the design. I mean, when Jesus says in there's a speech he gives that's recorded in at least two of the Gospels, the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain, and in one of them, in the Gospel of Matthew, there's a long list of eight Beatitudes, if you've heard of the Beatitudes.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of them are things that are not considered good in social society. And especially the last one is, blessed are the persecuted. I mean, Jesus is not only modeling how to undermine these power structures, and he does it frequently throughout his public ministry, but he's telling other people, look, you're going to have to do this too, because these things are going to find you. And how are you going to behave when they do? I mean, he teaches people to undermine these social structures. He teaches people to undermine monopoly violence institutions. He teaches people to assert their dignity, to have some substance to their behavior and their worldview and their perspectives that can act as a counterweight to the signals they receive from everywhere else. And that in living these things and modeling them for others, the church grows very organically. The church doesn't grow because people march in with armies and tell people, you follow our rules now. The church grows because people undermine these very power structures, which gets a lot of them persecuted, but it also gets so many more people who are curious enough to give this a chance. And it's stunning. And it leads to a lot of people who I think are more genuine in their faith. The problem of Constantine is also it changes the incentive structure of what it means to be a Christian. You know, because now there's social status attached to it.
Right, you're not being persecuted anymore.
Yeah, and not only that, but you get something if you self-identify as Christian.
Mm.
It totally changes the incentive structure. So now you get a lot of what's called like nominal Christianity, where people are Christian in name, even if they're just doing what they've always done. You know, Constantine doesn't stop being emperor simply because he starts talking like a Christian more often. You know, it used to be that if you were, and there are some saints, I can't recall the names off the top of my head, but there were saints in the early church who had been Roman soldiers. And in order to join the church, they had to renounce being a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
They had to renounce that imperial structure and that social order because it's a totally different value system.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just the Romans. It's almost everywhere in the ancient times. And it's everywhere today. Every government in the world, every monopoly violence institution, every might makes right mindset and social order, all of those things are the things that Jesus pushed against from underneath. He wasn't a conqueror trying to come in from above. He was an underminer. It was a little Irish democracy, right? Just don't comply and do the good thing on your own. And that's good neighbor, bad citizen. You can't separate those two with Jesus. Not only is he not a good citizen, but you can't separate it into, oh, he's just a troublemaker. No, he's a person doing good and teaching good and modeling good and giving a good example.
So when you say bad citizen, what is that? I think that's not something you'd hear from most churches today.
Not today.
You know, and you talk to most, even like serious Christians, there's still this vein of, well, respect authority, respect, you know, the power structures, all that stuff. What does it mean? What do you mean by bad citizen?
Well, he doesn't take his cues from the structures of citizenship. I went through in the introduction, there's a little bit of a litany there where I sort of keep contrasting them. It's right there, page 5, which is where the introduction starts.
Yes.
Good neighbors treat each other as peers. Good citizens treat each other according to official status. Good neighbors seek the personal, intimate betterment of themselves and each other. Good citizens seek the external validation of an impersonal system. Good neighbors align to voluntary, open-ended interactions. Good citizens align to coercive civil authority and imposed hierarchical social order. Good neighbors insource their ethics. Charity and friendship are the key virtues of their relationships. Good citizens outsource their ethics. Compliance with the commands of rulers and enforcers is a fundamental and necessary aspect. Some might call it a civic virtue. Good neighbors consent. Good citizens conform. These things oppose each other. If you're really doing one, you're not doing the other.
Yeah.
There is an exclusivity between the two. You can't insource your ethics and develop your conscience and at the same time just do what you're told.
Yeah, yeah. So here's a question. What about, and I'm interested in your view on this and also what you think Jesus's view would have been. What about the authority of the Bible?
The authority of the Bible. I'm not sure if authority, the way I'm talking about social authority, applies to a written work, because the written work is a fixed form. Jesus spends most of his public ministry correcting people's mistakes, right? And it's people who understand the old, who are familiar enough with the old scriptures. So the words written down don't have a lot of authority on their own. The concepts behind them might have a truth to them. Jesus himself speaks with a presence and an appeal to principles, but he doesn't do appeal to authority with people. Like, for instance, he doesn't go around saying, "I'm God, you should do what I tell you." Like, not at all. That's not his approach at all, because he obviously understands that he'd be leading people to a bad way of thinking and a bad way of being if he just says, "Look, I'm the new authority. You know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss," or, you know, that's usually how it turns out. "Look, you're following the wrong people. Do what I tell you instead." That's not his call. His call is to demonstrate things to people and to encourage them to embody it on their own, really develop their conscience. He's so different from the other people around them, even their own religious orders who've become sort of civil authorities as well.
So I don't think
the written word has an authority the way a person and a social structure has an authority. A written document might be a guide for people who develop a social structure. And in that case, the Bible can help you there. But the Bible itself is, Bible is God's gradual revelation in human history. And the danger in reading the Bible from page one is that the early stuff from the Hebrew scriptures is people who have a lot to learn. And by the time you get to Jesus, you realize people still have a lot to learn, but at least now the best teacher possible is there, leading by example. So there's a danger in reading a Bible's a collection of books written by, it's dozens of books written by dozens of authors over the course of several centuries. And it's people with varying degrees of insight and getting it right. So it's dangerous to tell people if it's written in the Bible, then it must be true, or it must be something that you should emulate because the Bible is full of people sinning. You should not emulate that.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there that I've got questions about.
There's a lot of people getting things wrong in the Bible, you know? And thank goodness for the Israelites, because they were very honest about their history. You know, we hear the term history is written by the winners. You know, history is written by the people who triumph. The Israelite people, in writing their history, they keep in a lot of the ugly parts and the ugly parts about their leaders. And towards the end of what we would call the BC period of history, the Israelite people have lost their kingdom. They've lost their earthly regime. They've lost that earthly community. But enough of them decide, you know what, we're going to keep our history, we're going to keep our holy books. You know, these things don't get trampled. Like, nobody worships Zeus anymore. Why? Because the ancient Greeks got conquered. Nobody worships Jupiter anymore. Why? Because the ancient Romans got conquered. You know, some of these other, you know, gods that were made up, they were just manifestations of what people believed, and they infused it into their social order. And it was literally, if you went to war with another tribe and you defeated them, it meant that your God was stronger. Quite literally. Because your God is your highest value, and your highest value is your social order.
Right.
And if your social order wins, your God is stronger. And so, you know, at some point, enough of the ancient Israelites figure out that truth is not determined by who wins wars. And so they keep their history, even though they've been conquered and vanquished and dispersed throughout, you know, who knows where. And so when Jesus shows up, there's enough of that where he can talk to an occupied people, a dispersed people, a people who's been conquered, and talk to them about truth, and not do it because he's got an army behind him who's conquering the Romans and kicking them out. Some people thought the Messiah was going to be that. The Jewish Messiah would be this military hero.
Right.
And that's why they were confused by Jesus. But there's enough of that. And thank goodness the Israelites and the Hebrew people figured that out enough. They didn't get there all the way, but they got there enough to really change the view of truth and the view of why your history matters. Your history doesn't matter because you conquered someone else. Your history matters to the extent that you found something that was actually true, something that could agree with reality, something that could be applied more than to just your own feelings.
And it seems like that approach, you know, when you talk to a lot of Christians, American Christians, that doesn't seem to be their approach to spiritual truth or to discovering God or to understanding God. It seems very much to be an authoritarian relationship with this book. And, you know, and then you can ask, you know, well, which version of the book, which are we talking King James? Are we talking the Geneva Bible? Which one are you talking about? Mm-hmm. But it's like the inquiry stops there. It's not, it seems like it's for so many people, it's not a relationship of inquiry with God or with spiritual reality or a real search for the truth. It's more, I'm going to follow the rules. I'm going to make sure I'm going to do everything the Bible says, you know, whichever version I have, so that I can get into heaven, so that I don't go to hell. And to me, that just seems, that seems very empty.
And it's the citizenship version of Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah, but it seems to be the dominant version too.
Yes, since Constantine onward. Yes, yes. Now that you get social status by identifying with Christianity, yes. And now that Christianity too often looks like the same structure as your government, yes, and that's true in the U.S.
So where
you can't be
go?
President unless you say you're a Christian.
And then go bomb everywhere.
And then go bomb it. Yeah, right. Not actually be a Christian, but just say you're a Christian.
So where does someone go if someone's really interested in learning about Jesus, in following the teachings of Jesus? Are there any churches that you think are like legitimate, or maybe not churches? Maybe there's something else. Where does someone go who doesn't want the good citizen version of Christianity?
Well, it's tough to do that in a place where Christianity, at least in its nominal form, has been elevated. Remember, a church is a community of believers, and humans aren't perfect. So you're never going to find a perfect church. And actually, if you're looking for a perfect church to tell you what to do, you're falling into this.
Yeah.
You know enough to realize that the people telling you things to do aren't getting it right. But instead of taking sort of the Christ encouraged way, you're simply looking for someone else to tell you what to do.
Yeah.
So if your approach to Christianity is, I'm trying to find someone to tell me what to do that feels better to me.
Well, or what about maybe not necessarily someone to tell, you know, not necessarily an authority figure, but maybe just a community of like-minded people who are sincere in their interest in
that's the word
of Jesus.
That's the word, sincere, right? So you're looking for things that are not hypocritical, no hypocrisy, no double speak. Jesus calls that out during his public ministry. You know, woe to you hypocrites, people who say one thing and do another. So look for sincerity out of people. Look for a lot of the things that we consider to be, say, anarchistic or voluntarist, people who operate based on consent, because that's how Jesus operated with people. Mm-hmm. People who really encounter one another as human beings with agency. You respect that about another person. There are plenty of people who, when Jesus tried to explain something, said, we think you're not right. We think you're crazy. And they walked away. And I mean, Jesus let them go. He didn't run after them and, you know, try and grab them by the arm and say, no, you have to stay.
Yeah.
So look for, I think, that sincerity, that behavior that is consistent and that's deeper than the surface. I, of course, do cite the Bible in this book. It's very gospel based. Mm-hmm. I even threw an appendix in the back.
Yeah.
I had to, because the book had to be at least 62 pages to get a spine. So I started looking, oh my goodness, yeah, what can I throw in here to get to 62 pages at least? And I threw an appendix at the back, and there's all sorts of Bible sections and either phrases or short passages that I do cite in the book. So I think finding a good Bible, I use the one that it's a study Bible that the Catholic Church puts out. It's translated into English, but it also includes contextual notes. You know, if you read it online and get a good study Bible, you'll get not only the text of the scripture, but you'll get cross-references to other places in the Bible where that idea or even maybe that exact wording comes from. And you'll get contextual nice notes about what it meant to be alive at that time and what some of these mm-hmm references might have meant, which I go through in other parts of the book. There are things that are misinterpreted simply because people aren't necessarily being malicious, but they just have no idea what these things mean 2,000 years ago in a culture that's occupied by Romans.
Right, right.
So there's a lot to do there. You have to wrestle with it, but you have to be willing to do it. You said earlier about wanting the easy way out and not wanting to put effort into it. The word Israel means one who wrestles with God.
Hmm.
That was their defining characteristic of their ancient societies. These were people who grappled, wow, who wrestled with God. Not because they were trying to get one over on God or were trying to kick out God, but because that's how you get stronger. A sparring partner.
Hmm.
You know, someone who will exercise with you. You know, and God wanted them to wrestle. God still does. God wants us to wrestle. I don't have any credentials as a book writer or anything, but I have taught religious education to kids, teenagers, adults. And especially when teaching adults, I tell them about that. And I say, look, wrestle with God. You know, bring your questions to our sessions. Bring your the things that stand out to you. Bring the things you're maybe confused by and wrestle with it. But know that you're going to have to wrestle on your own. Like, someone else can't live your faith for you, nor can someone else give you their faith. When we talk about that and use those words like, oh, I'm passing on my faith to my children. Not really.
Yeah.
No, that's not how it works. You know, you can,
yeah,
you can show your faith to someone and you can share your faith with someone and you can help someone find their faith, but you can't give them your faith and you can't practice their faith for them.
Right.
That's right. Not what it is. You know, it's something deeply innate, and it's innate to the individual. It's not a microcosm that you get from a group. It's not groupthink. It's not identity politics. It's not mm-hmm collectivism. The fact that we join together as church to share our faith and encourage one another is not an expression of collectivism, because we're not putting aside our experience and then assuming a microcosm of the group experience to be our own. No, right, we bring our own experience to the community and we encourage each other to keep going, to fight the good fight against those things that trouble us, that we're struggling with. But it's not an identity politics. It's turned into that in the U.S. almost.
Right,
you identify right as Christian to get things. Mm-hmm. You go to a church to that set has yourself status
apart, to set, or even to set yourself apart from what you see as, you know, the corrupt rest of the world. It's like, well, I'm going to identify over here,
mm-hmm,
but it seems like you can still fall into that same trap by doing that.
Sure, because it's more than a label. You don't. It's not a label that you wear on your shirt.
Yeah.
You know, like whatever your clothing labels are, it's not that. And if you're, that's not what sets you apart. It's how you It's how you live in the world that sets you apart. You know, not just something easy to slap onto yourself, like you're a product.
Right.
And it's like, well, this is my brand and my label. That's it. You know, wearing it on your sleeve, wearing your faith on your sleeve, that's not the goal. Goal is to cultivate your faith in your heart, your center of yourself, and then to have that emerge out of you as you express yourself in the world. It's not something that originates outside of you and you slap on your outside surface and aha, you know, it's not a right. nicotine patch that kind of absorbs into your bloodstream a little bit here and there until you got to throw the next patch on or the next patch on. It's something that you cultivate in you that then emerges from you as you behave and interact and be in the world. And in Christianity, something that bugs me when I go into a church is I'll see the American flag up near the altar.
Yeah.
Oh, that just, the early church are rolling over in their catacombs. Could you imagine that? In the early church,
yeah.
having, you know, Roman imperial emblems where they were gathering to embody their highest values and putting that in a place of prominence and reverence. Oh my goodness, is that, it's disgusting to me. Thankfully, my parish church, the pastor a few years ago took that out from the altar area and threw it into the back. It's still there in the back of the church,
nice.
Which still annoys me, but at least it's not occupying, you know, the area of greater prominence where yeah. your attention is supposed to be drawn. Like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Unless he painted a big black X through it, you know, or something, that would be one thing. But yeah, in American churches, government is considered prominent because a lot of people have been fooled into thinking that there's something good about our government. It's right. always the other guy's government right. that's bad. Our government is good. Our government is innately good if only the right people would be in charge of it.
Right, right.
Our
government is good, but right now it's messed up. But if we just get the right people in, then it'll be good again. But we'll still have
vote
that
harder.
Flag up there. Yeah, yeah.
Vote harder. Get the right people involved. Let's just pass better legislation.
Yeah,
And I attack that in this book.
So you've got a quote in here which I love.
Okay.
Which is going to make a lot of Christians angry, I think. It's
okay.
on page 44.
Okay.
Good cops kill Jesus.
Yep. I get asked about that quite a lot. In fact, one of the reviewers on Amazon quoted that in his review that he left on Amazon, which was very kind of him and wonderful to do. But yes, everybody has asked me about who has a long conversation with me has asked me about, yes, station 12, when Jesus dies on the cross. Yeah, good cops kill Jesus. Not bad cops, not rogue cops, not corrupt cops. Good cops. The ones who obey orders and follow their training and protocols. The ones who care about their communities and keep the streets safe and secure. The ones who are just doing their jobs and trying to go home to their families. Hey, they don't make the rules. They just enforce them. Stop resisting. Good cops kill Jesus. Yeah. Yep. Find the lie. Tell me I'm wrong.
I can't.
Right?
But have you received any backlash? Are there Christians who take you to task for that?
No one yet, at least not outwardly. They may be stewing over it themselves. I joke that I don't think any hardcore churchgoers have found the book yet because I haven't gotten any one-star reviews yet on the book
yeah.
sites.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting for that because I'm waiting for the people who actually worship imposed order and who have basically renamed Christ to be that. I'm waiting for those people who are in the church because of its the sense of imposed order, that control freak tendency that we have in us, that they for some reason, find in the church, and it's there, unfortunately. I'm waiting for those people to read this book and to have that thrown off. You know, I say sometimes that everybody in the world starts out worshiping Marduk, you know, an ancient god of imposed order. We all do it. We worship imposed order. We're all Marduk worshipers. All the gods are just different names from Marduk.
So I'm not no biblical scholar here, but in the Bible, when the Israelites are given a choice and they choose, mm-hmm. they choose to have a king, and yeah. God's like, are you guys sure? Are you sure that's what you want? And what's the meaning of that? What do you read into that story, or how do you feel that has sort of set the stage for where we are now?
I think it's the first book of Samuel, and it's the Israelite people instituting a monopoly violence institution, a regime, over the objections of God. And they're doing it because they look at everybody around them who has this, and they say, we want that too. We want what they have. We want a king. We want someone to exalt and to look up to. We want a person who flaunts power and riches. We want that because that's in you. That's the psychological path of least resistance. That's in us as humans.
Yeah.
That desire for imposed order. We all worship imposed order until a few of us don't, right? But we all do it, and it's so easy to fall back into it if you've never gotten there. And the early church was an alternative to imposed order. From Constantine onward, the church is not an alternative to imposed order. It's a friend of it. It's a crony. It's an accessory. It's another version of it. The American churches, modern Western churches, are just imposed order with different language.
Yeah.
You know, like Christ came to save us from Marduk in all Marduk's various names, not to give us, not to be a different Marduk.
Yeah.
He came to oppose that, to undermine that. He's a bad citizen, you know, and the idea that being a good Christian means that you're a good citizen of your regime. That's a problem. That's really a problem. You know, that you're not called to that kind of worldview and that kind of expression towards your fellow humans. And yet that has become acceptable for so many nominally Christian communities, including ones with long histories and grand hierarchies that are well known all over the world, with large congregation and large networks, and who have become somewhat centralized over the centuries, that have large conventions and, you know, things that we would associate with that look a heck of a lot like the regime that Constantine somehow got the church to adopt.
Yeah,
if Constantine and didn't
the
convert
regime
to Christianity,
that killed Jesus.
Pardon?
And the regime that killed Jesus.
Right, and the regime that killed Jesus, maybe they were too far removed, you know, after 2.5 centuries, almost 3 centuries, to just realize it. Maybe they were beaten down by too much persecution and realized that, I don't know how long we can keep doing this, but whatever it was, the invitation that Constantine extended to be friends and to be more like each other, that invitation was accepted. By the way, that's the invitation of Judas in the Bible.
Huh.
Right? Judas doesn't want Jesus to be killed. When he finds out that the Sanhedrin is trying to kill Jesus, Judas freaks out. That wasn't his idea. Judas wants them to be better friends because it would be better for everybody. It would be better for their popularity. It would be safer. They wouldn't have to keep fleeing from certain towns and villages once people got mad at them. You know, why can't you just be better friends? You know, Judas is trying to force the new wine into the old wineskins. right? The old wineskin of top-down imposed order. You know, stop fighting that. Just kind of be friends with them. We'll all make more money.
Right, right.
We'll all have more status. We'll have more friends. People will like us. We won't have to be so nomadic and being chased out of cities because we're not respectable people anymore. You know, why? Let's just be better friends with them. And that's the Judas model.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that.
It's to throw Jesus, it's to make Jesus fit into these other power structures.
Mm-hmm, to compromise with it.
Yes, it's to reshape Jesus into these other things. It's things that Jesus explicitly warned not to do. And with Constantine, that becomes the norm. And you saw it during COVID. You brought that up very early in our conversation. Yeah. You know, I'll go right after, you know, my own in this, even though I don't like talking in like collectivist terms. I'll go right after the U.S. Catholic bishops here. Anybody listening here who wants to chime in the comments, send me a message. Send Brittany a message on my behalf to hand to me. Find me a U.S. bishop during the last 4 years who was not a Judas, who did not turn in Jesus for their paycheck protection money program, who did not go along with the idea that, well, this isn't really important. And don't give me the answer, well, they were just trying to keep people safe, because Judas was just trying to keep them safe too.
Yep. Yep.
I don't think there's anywhere in the Gospels where Jesus says, hey, above all, make sure you're safe. Like, that's at odds with blessed are the persecuted. That's at odds with teaching people how to assert their dignity when they're being abused, when they're being put down, when they're being subjugated, when they're being violated, when they're being forced into these things. Like, don't tell me they're trying to keep people safe, because that's what Judas was doing too. Find me a U.S. bishop who was not Judas from 2020 on. Maybe you can find some that weren't before then, but you will go right back to the beginning of this conversation. And and if you want to do that with your denomination of Christianity, go for it. Find somebody who wasn't a Judas. And they did it, and it was so easy because they're already thinking that way. They're already thinking like, oh, we have to be good citizens. We have to be a good Christian, you have to be a good citizen.
Yeah. There were a few, and like, I remember in California, there were a couple churches that stayed open that defied the orders, and that there was one that sued Newsom and won, you know, because clearly it's a violation of religious freedom. So very few, though. And then there was the pastor up in Canada who was arrested for
that one.
But so few, so very few. And it reminds me of, during the Holocaust, when Jewish religious leaders were used to help sort of round up their congregations. They were used to keep track. They had lists to keep track of who was in their congregation and to keep the government, you know, apprised of where people were and what their names were and all this stuff. And they didn't do it because they hated their people. They didn't do it because, you know, they were, you know, darkly evil and were on the side of the Nazis. They somehow thought they were keeping them safe. They somehow thought they were being good citizens, you know, doing the right thing, not stepping out of line, you know, whatever it was. And if you bring, you know, Hannah Arendt, you know, got a lot of grief for bringing this up. Nobody wanted to talk about this afterwards, but it's precisely what happened. They went along to get along. They, you know, took the easy way out. They were good citizens, and their people died because of it.
Yes. And all because they thought they were going to keep people safe, like you said, right? Since when is that the goal? Like, you know, you might keep your toddler safe if they're getting too close to the knives or the electrical outlet, because your toddler doesn't know any better and there's imminent danger.
Yeah.
But the idea that you would keep people safe by making them even more subject to oppressive power structures and top-down order and training them to be more obedient to what people of social status tell them. And I think that's a problem in a lot of churches today, because they're set up the same way. You're told to just do what the pastor tells you, do what the priest tells you, do what the minister tells you. Like, that's your job. Just do what they tell you. It's outsourcing your ethics. It's a sign of good citizenship, but not good neighborliness. You know, just do what you're told. And then, because it's a shortcut to responsibility. If I do what I'm told, then I've been virtuous. Because all I was supposed to do was obey.
Yeah.
If it turns out I did something terrible, it's not my fault. It's the fault of whoever told me. This is the defense at the Nuremberg trials, isn't it?
Yeah.
We were just following orders. We were virtuous. We followed orders. No, you weren't virtuous. You outsourced your ethics. At no point are you virtuous if you outsource your ethics. It is impossible to be virtuous while outsourcing your ethics. Virtue is a taking of responsibility, an accepting of responsibility for not only actions, but intentions. If you outsource that, you have now abandoned any claim to virtue. That's why I contrast real virtue with the civic virtue of citizens. And I do it right in the introduction, which I was having a conversation with one person who said, you know, I usually skip the introduction of books, but I read this one and I'm glad I did. And I was like, yeah, I'm glad you did too. Because there's a lot there. Yes.
Yeah. And I marked a couple of, there was a quote that I wanted to.
Sure, so let's go. Let's
page,
talk.
Yeah, let's look at page 37. Okay. So this is interesting. You say there are zero examples in the Gospels of Jesus teaching coercive, invasive acts to keep social order. Zero. While Jesus is certainly against sinful behavior, he offers no justification for individuals nor institutions threatening or inflicting harm, even towards the guilty. So that's something that I think, you know, a lot of modern day Christians would have trouble with. I'm curious, though, are there examples that you can think of where he explicitly speaks out against coercive institutions or a coercive order?
In a sense, he does it right in the gospel passage I cited before you very kindly read there. It was Jewish elders enforcing their law against the woman caught in adultery. And Jesus doesn't say, well, no, she's innocent. He says, okay, yes, she's guilty, but where do you guys get off inflicting this kind of punishment on someone for that? So that's, to me, a very explicit. Because what they're doing there, that's, we don't look at that as a government function, but that's what it is. These were civic leaders who had a mandate. They had their majority behind them, the mob, so they had their majority. People supported this, you know, the ordinary people supported this, and leaders were enforcing the law. Well, it's the law. We have to do it. Moses said we should. You know, it's like appealing to the law book or the Constitution or whatever, and they were doing it. And Jesus says, okay, yeah, this thing that she did is wrong. You're correct. But what you're about to do is even worse. And Jesus sort of appeals to enough of their individuality and enough of their neighborliness that they one by one disperse. So there's your example. There's the most obvious example I could find, and I put it in the book because I wanted to drive it home to people. And I wanted to do it with a passage that you've probably heard of before, but may have misinterpreted. or maybe not have gotten the full meaning of what was going on there. Like in context of what's going on there, that this is Jesus standing up to the government, to the enforcers who want to inflict the penalties of the law on someone who broke the law.
Was Jesus an anarchist?
I don't think they used that word back then, but it sure seems like it to me. Jesus, I started a Substack based on this book called Good Neighbor, Bad Citizen.
And I'll link to that.
And in my very first post, I tied together anarchy with Jesus. I think Jesus is an anarchist, but he's more than that. Because anarchy just tells you what to be against. And a lot of Christianity gets that same bad rap because what most people know are the Ten Commandments, which are basically telling you what not to do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, anarchy gets that same, so you're just against things. So, yes, Jesus is an anarchist, but he's more than that because he's not simply against things. He's not simply a bad citizen. He's a bad citizen because he's such a good neighbor. And being a good neighbor eventually makes you run afoul of these social orders.
Right.
He's an anarchist because he's such a good Jesus. Right. So I think he is. I think it's quite clear that he's an anarchist. But he doesn't stop there. An anarchist isn't where he starts either. He doesn't start at anarchy and then stop there. He starts with substance, and the substance teaches you what needs to be in absence. Goodness teaches you what to do and what not to do. Goodness teaches you to avoid evil because you know so much about the good that you recognize when something is not good. Yeah. Not that you're told what's evil first. And then you wind up, well, if it's not explicitly evil that I've been told about, I guess it's good to do. And it turns out, no, that's not the case. Right. Learn substance first. Or, you know, you kind of learn them together. You learn what to do and what not to do, and they grow together.
But it's an internal knowledge, though. It's not like a list of rules.
It can't be, because the list would be forever.
Yeah.
Every time you encountered something new, you'd have to add to your list.
Yeah.
Right. And then you'd get confused. Like, is that on the list already? Is there something that's similar on that list? There's a movement in modern American Christianity called WWJD. What would Jesus do?
Yeah.
And I don't like that because it kind of turns Jesus into a hypothetical. If I'm trying to look to Jesus for advice on what to do, I don't try and look for a specific thing or try and make Jesus my hypothetical imaginary friend. What would Jesus do? I look and say, what does Jesus teach? What does Jesus model? Because if you're looking for a list of things to do, you're not going to find a long enough list in the gospel.
Yeah.
But if you're looking for principles and examples of somebody living those principles, and those principles then become the thing that grounds you, and from those principles, you can answer any list item that could ever possibly come up. Yes, right. You will find that from Jesus. So what does Jesus model? Look to Jesus's life. Don't try and start with a hypothetical that you're then going to rationalize backwards to Jesus. Mm-hmm. Look to the model of Jesus. If you get that, you'll have the principle that allows you, you'll have the toolkit that allows you to encounter and engage with whatever's troubling you in your life.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, and this is a little bit unfair because Jesus wasn't a
political. Go for it.
Okay, Jesus wasn't a political scientist, and he didn't come up with a political model of how society should be organized.
Of course not.
But given, you know, living from the principles that he lived from and that he modeled for us, how should society, or how do you believe we should deal with criminals, or, you know, people who, you know, invaders, people who want to do violence to each other? I feel like, you know, turn the other cheek is not going to be a satisfying answer for a lot of people. So what do you see as being a civil order or a social order that's in conformity with Jesus's values?
A lot of the early church communities managed to do this. They were successful, very much so, in winning people over to it by their example. I think a social order is consent-based. It's encounter-based. Every miracle that Jesus performs that's recorded for us in the Bibles, for people, every miracle he does for people is the result of an encounter. So someone has to be willing to step forward and encounter first. I think consent is a big deal. I think human dignity is a big deal for social orders. And being neighborly. Like, Jesus is not against communities and associations. He's not against what we would call the division of labor. Right? He's not against people being good at one thing and not so good at the other thing, so they do the thing they're good at and they trade with each other. He's not against that at all. And you see that further in the New Testament. Things like some of St. Paul's encouragements to people that, yes, I know you're different. You have different gifts, but they're all valuable. So learn to use them. So Jesus is not against associations. He's not against communities. He's not against networking. He's also not really against hierarchies. He's against hierarchies of violence and dominance. He's against social order that's imposed. But he's not against hierarchies of values. He has a hierarchy of values himself. He lives it. He's not against hierarchies of competence. He lives that also. You know, like Jesus goes around as an itinerant preacher, and he has to rely on other people for lodging and food. Because while Jesus is out preaching to people and teaching people and modeling things for people, he can't be farming and catching fish and raising animals and building houses. You know, so Jesus models that as well. So he's not against hierarchies of competence. He's not against hierarchies of proprietorship, where if you've taken the responsibility for something and you own it, you can delegate it to somebody else. Many of his parables involve that. You know, the master leaves on a long trip and leaves some of his possession to his faithful servants, that they now have a responsibility. So he's not against hierarchies of that. He's not against the authority of personhood. So there are all sorts of ways that people can interact with each other, and you probably already do this, but may not have put it into the ideas of, oh, so this really is anarchy, isn't it? You probably already meet your neighbors and people in your communities and your towns and your cities without wondering, oh, who's the superior here and who's the inferior? You probably meet them in consent-based interactions where you're both there voluntarily. And if you trade with each other, you do it voluntarily. You know, you invite someone over to your home, or you accept an invitation to someone else's home. You don't just barge in and act like you own the place. Right, you may have a job where you work for someone else, where that person has delegated some of their property to you, and it's now your responsibility to do it because you've accepted that. And if one or both of you decide not to continue that agreement, then you move on and you find something else to do. You know, so we already do these things.
What about crime though? What about, you know, how would a community like that handle, you know, somebody who didn't behave that way, who went around, you know, stealing or assaulting, murdering people?
You would defend yourself in the moment. You could also defend yourself. You could also defend someone else who's being attacked who you saw it was. What you would not do is turn it into vengeance, where you would do the evil to the other person.
Mm-hmm.
That was the old eye for an eye method of justice, where justice is, all right, do the evil that's been done to you. Jesus is not encouraging that, because frankly, that never ends, does it?
Yeah.
Like there's always going to be someone else who now has a beef with you because of what you did in trying to solve crime. So I think there's you can certainly defend your property. You can defend and protect other people. You can make it really difficult for people to steal from you and to violate you. You could certainly make it really difficult and not give them an incentive to do so. There's nothing unchristian about genuine defenses that don't ostracize people ahead of time and don't preemptively consider others to be evil and threatening. And this is why I hate the analogy of the national borders to your house. Like, well, do you have a door on your house? Do you close it at night?
Right.
Well, the national border is just like your door. No, it's not.
Yeah.
No, no, it's not. Yeah. No, imaginary lines in the desert drawn by psychopaths and sociopaths are not the same as your property that you actually cultivate and that you just close the door on and you make someone knock first and enter. No, that's not a good analogy at all. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. No, no. Yeah. So yeah, like, sure, have a door and have a lock on your door.
Is there any place in the Christian worldview, is there any place for punishment, punishment of crimes?
There's a place for making people whole again. There's a place for penance, mm-hmm. if it can be done. There's a place for making people whole again. If something's stolen from you, if it can be retrieved. Yes, there's a place for making people whole. But the notion of justice in our modern world, like criminal justice, like the state is a party in the criminal proceedings. Like it's so-and-so versus the state or the state versus so-and-so. Yeah. Like that's not there's nothing about putting someone in a cage that makes a person who's actually been victimized whole again.
Right.
That's just the state jumping in and say, oh no, we're the real victim and we're going to extract something.
Yeah.
It's like, no, the state is not the victim in a crime between other people. Like society is an abstraction. Society is not a victim. An individual human being is a victim.
Yeah.
So making that actual victim whole can be part of justice to give people what is due to them. But setting up an impositional system that extracts punishments for deterrence or to make examples out of people, that's what the Israelites and Romans conspired to do to Jesus. Like Jesus committed a crime against the state, not against any actual person. No individual human being was ever violated by Jesus, but quote unquote, the state was victimized by Jesus. The abstraction, the order was victimized by Jesus. That was Jesus' crime. The crime was against the order, against this weird abstraction that becomes manifest because people have their psychology screwed on the wrong way. And they enforced it. And they paraded him as a deterrent. And in no way was this justice, if you have a Christian mindset. But to them it was. And they did it. And they thought they were right. And they thought they were virtuous. And the enforcers who were carrying it out were good cops, as you brought up.
Yep.
They were the good cops, not the bad cops, not the corrupt cops, not the rogue cops. It was the good cops enforcing the good laws that had been given to them by their good leaders and good rulers, because the abstraction of society and government and imposed hierarchy was their highest value. That's not justice. There are ways to behave justly with people, even people you disagree with, even people who don't act like you do, and it's going to be difficult. It will be difficult. You know, it's not easy to have a consent-based interaction with everybody you meet. It's not easy to have this kind of society and community. It's not easy. It's not risk-free. It's not safe. It's not always safe to do this. Yeah. You're taking a risk in treating people with dignity. You're taking a risk in being a neighbor to people who may have ulterior motives. But the alternative is just to enshrine ulterior motives and dress it up in suits and ties and lipstick and eyeshadow and powdered wigs and fancy titles and ranks and status.
Yeah.
You're not getting rid of the risk, and you're not getting rid of
your institutional
people who steal. You're not getting rid of crime and violence by simply enshrining it.
Yeah.
You're not solving the problem. You're dressing up the problem as something you consider to be acceptable enough. And worse off, you start worshiping it as if the problem is actually the solution.
Yeah.
So well, no, if you want to be a follower of Christ, it's going to be tough. You're going to have to wrestle with God in order to get the courage to do it. And you're going to have to wrestle with how you interact with other people. It's going to be tough, but you know, it's worth it. Jesus doesn't say it'll be easy. He says it will be blessed.
So that's, I want to go into that point a little bit. You know, he told his followers it was going to be difficult, you know, and their lives were difficult. They were persecuted. They were, you know, chased from place to place, all this stuff. Do you think that was his vision for how it was always going to be? Does it in all of human history, is it always going to have to be like that? That the people who live by these principles are going to be persecuted and, you know, pursued by the state and chased down and all this stuff? Or think he believed? So it's always, that's just the human condition.
It is. Jesus comes to show us how to redeem. God wants to redeem the human condition, not to conquer it or satiate it or trick it into something. And I go through that a little bit in one of the stations. I think it's station 3, where we talk about Jesus falling for the first time as he carries his cross.
For God didn't take on human form to satiate, deny, or oppress, but to redeem.
Yes. So the psychological path of least resistance will always be there as long as humans have psyches. So humans will always gravitate towards imposed order. We all worship Marduk. Some of us just realize it and get out of it. But everybody has as their highest value imposed order at some point in their lives. We're born into it. Even the ancient Israelite people who had been shown the beginnings of a better way said, "Now we want the pageantry and the spectacle and the human status of all of these other things. We want that, you know." And you can go through 1 Samuel if you want to read more about that. But yes, so that's always there. And Jesus in his ministry talks about, there will be more wars. He talks about this while he's carrying his cross, the station where he consoles the weeping women and tells them about how difficult life is going to get.
Yes.
You know, like, there's still more bad things on the horizon here.
Yeah.
You know, that's station 8. He's telling them, like, you know, Jesus reminds them that at present he is bearing the brunt of the ire from civil authorities. In the future, however, that primitive human desire for power and violent rivalry will endanger many more people. This is part of the human condition. So, no, I don't think it's going away. I think God wants to point us to making a better world. And that starts with us and with the people closest to us and how we interact with people. A better world happens not with how we imagine abstractions will behave. It starts with us having that goal in mind of being more like the good neighbor. And then as we live that out to the people we meet, to the people we work with, to the people we do have disagreements with and honest rivalries with, in true, genuine, messy anarchy and voluntarism. You know, there are rivalries because we do things differently. We have different preferences. We have different personality traits, and we have different things that we're good at. Jesus does not call us to get rid of what makes us who we are. He calls us to find the best parts of ourselves and do that more often than the worst parts of ourselves. He calls us to be individuals, not microcosms of some epitomized, idealized, quote unquote, Christian.
Right. And not to outsource an understanding of that of those values to some other entity or some other person.
No, you're allowed to have other people help you learn and teach you. And that's a big part of what we do as church, or what we should be doing as church. But at no point do you outsource your critical thinking and especially your ethics to someone else, where you fall into, well, I'm virtuous because I did what I was told.
Yeah.
So yes, learn from each other, have other people point you to things. I've learned from people. I wrote a book and a blog where I think there's things to be learned there. I refine my own thinking and my own encapsulation of things as I write it. I'm sure you found that about yourself, because you're a writer yourself, that, you know, getting your own thoughts on paper helps you refine them.
Yeah, you see where things don't make sense. And
you catch yourself in your own hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Like you catch yourself in your own BS.
Yep.
Right. Sometimes. So yes, learn from the world, learn from people, but don't outsource your ethics to other people. Let other people encourage you, perhaps be inspired by the good that people do, but don't outsource your good feeling to don't live through someone else.
Yeah.
Do the opposite. Let Christ live through your soul. Don't live through other people. Don't live vicariously through someone else. Find the holy transcendent that's in your soul and let that live through you as you behave. That's the message of Christ. More than anything, be a good neighbor. It will make you a bad citizen, but be a good neighbor. It's worth it.
This has been awesome. This is really fantastic. This is the book, Good Neighbor, Bad Citizen. I'm going to post a link to it. I'll post a link to your Substack. Is there any other way that people can find you, or any other links that you'd like people to know about?
I've recently started a Twitter.
Okay.
I've jumped into the cesspool of dumpster fires known as Twitter.
Wow.
I'm there as Good Nay Bad Sit, because they only give you 15 characters. So it's Good Neighbor minus the B-O-R, Bad Citizen minus the isn.
Okay.
Good Nay Bad Sit. I'm on there, and I'm just basically trying to find other, react to and sometimes share and sometimes comment on other things that are looking to do the good neighbor, bad citizen model, other anarchist and voluntarists who are figuring out that the imposed social order, the psychological path of least resistance is not the best of humanity, is not the best of themselves as individual human beings, is not the best of themselves as a unique and special soul having a human experience, and is not the best thing to try and impart into your communities and your friendships and your connections and your community. So I'm there. So really, I've got a book, I've got a Substack based on the book, and I've got a Twitter that's trying to expand the conversation for both of those. You could find me on Facebook, where I'm, it's just a personal profile, though. It's not sort of a professional profile. So you could find me there as well. I do post a lot of things online that are for public consumption. Like, I don't post a lot of things that are private just for small networks. So I've reached the point where whatever I say, I don't care who knows it. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Maybe you've gotten there too, you know. Obviously there's some things that are private. But
I don't post really personal stuff, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Brittany. This has been fun. This has been a lot of fun. I'm glad you enjoyed the book, and I'm glad that you had some questions for me about the book. It's fun talking about it.
Yeah. And I'm glad I'm going to be able to get this out before Christmas, because I think this is the perfect Christmas episode. So
Good. I've got a Christmas Substack coming up scheduled for December 20th. So
okay. Oh, that's this Wednesday. Okay, that's tomorrow, right?
I call it the Wednesday wake up. It's one weekly post. It's somewhere between 700 and 800 words. So it takes you maybe 3 or 4 minutes to read. I'm not going to take up a bunch of your time, but it's on the same sort of overall theme of good neighbor, bad citizen. And nice. I've got a Christmas one coming out for December 20th. So awesome. Depending on people, when people are listening to this conversation, you can go find that at goodneighborbadcitizen.substack.com and look for the December 20th entry. Look for the other ones too. I didn't start it that long ago, just in November. So there's only a few articles up there as of now, but I hope it grows, and I hope more people like to continue the conversation.
Yeah.
Because I think the biggest lesson of good neighbor, bad citizen is that it has to be something ongoing. It's not something you do once and you're done. Being a good neighbor is ongoing. It's a way of life. And as long as you're living, you have to be living this out. So I wanted to continue the conversation with people. I wanted to find people like you who wanted to talk.
Yeah.
I wanted to find people who wanted to keep writing.
Yeah. And it's such a huge conversation too. I feel like, I'll have you back on again, because I think there are so many offshoots from this that come up. And I feel like people are more interested now than perhaps in the past. So,
I hope so. If the last few years have made people question,
I think they have.
Why are they outsourcing all of their thinking?
Yeah.
Why are they outsourcing their ethics to experts and politicians? If it's made people question that, and now they're looking for, well, where do I go?
Yeah.
Well, you go to become a better neighbor.
Yeah.
You go to wrestle with God and to work your muscles.
Yeah. Yeah.
You go for the substance, not simply the absence. So
yeah.
I'm an over-talker. I'll stop now.
We'll be back again. We'll have you back again. Thanks again so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to What Then Must We Do, the podcast for those who understand that the state is the problem and are seeking solutions. For more episodes, go to bretney.substack.com. That's bretigne.substack.com and subscribe.